relaxation. And I was believing, tuning in the energies and becoming present and then seeing what's going to happen. So just uncross your legs, sit up straight so that your breathing isn't compromised. And just let yourself breathe gently in through the nose, fill your stomach, allow the chest to remain relaxed. Take a deep breath in through your nose and slowly out through your nose. And just continue breathing deeply from your stomach until the oxygen that's entering your body is actually starting to release all the tension you've carried in the day. So feel your shoulders softening, your arms relaxing, knees and feet releasing. Any tension in your face melting. Just allow yourself fully present. And just go with the flow of your breathing until your stomach is relaxed. Your chest is relaxed. And the whole body starts to become soft. Enjoy letting yourself become soft. Slowly as you become soft, quiet, tranquil energy starts to take over. It's like someone has switched on a light inside. Light is like the rays of the sun warming you inside. As you concentrate on remaining present in this moment, with every breath you take. Slowly, slowly, you let yourself become peaceful. In this moment, imagine yourself to be cocooned in peace. You're in a safe place with safe company in a safe environment. Enjoy being. Whatever thoughts or images may come and go, like passing clouds, but become aware of yourself as an observer inside. Breathing. And the softness of this energy, all the hardness of the day, dissolves. And it's like going swimming in the ocean with the warm sun shining. Basking in this feeling, open your eyes and become conscious of where you are. Slip out of the go, go, go paradigm into a very soft being place if you let yourself stay there long enough. I was very intrigued by the subject that Sonia chose today. Not so much intrigued by the conflict resolution bit, but what intrigued me was the soft way, right? Who kind of caught that attention exactly? And I said to Sonia, so, okay, so what's the hard way then? You know, what is the soft And I guess on one level, what would a meditation teacher have anything to do with conflict resolution? But I've had the privilege of being with the Brahma Kumaris for a good 38 years. And I'm older than I look, but I won't tell you how old I am. But all I can say is meditation is a very good beauty treatment because it actually helps you. You look 20 years younger than you actually are. So over the last perhaps 6 or 7 years, the organization, which really the Brahma Kumaris as an institution, was really founded as a family movement 76 years ago in India, in part of India that is now Pakistan, that was called Sindh. And it started as a core nucleus of a group of individuals that began practicing some very deep spiritual principles and had a very deep commitment to transformation, personal transformation, societal transformation. And since time, as the organization, it didn't start off with the intention to become an organization, but as a family gets bigger and bigger and bigger, there is a need for a self-organizing to happen in the family, right? So when a family nucleus is small, you can handle things in a very informal way. But as it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and it expands, and it left India and exploded in 130 countries worldwide, and now has 5,500 branches worldwide, it's not just a family unit anymore, even though it operates with family principles. It's an organization. And so one of the things that probably began in the last 5 years for the organization was a review to continue to reconcile the expansion that we were experiencing with the values that we fundamentally started with. We all know that when something starts to get bigger, it's easy to lose connection with the seed, right? And so you get to a point and you're expanding and expanding and expanding and you don't know why you're expanding. And you think, well, why did I start this in the first place? What's happening? And so I began to see about 5 years ago, after 70 odd years, the organization really beginning a healthy review on aligning its functioning that had expanded back to its principles again. And they often say about most faith-based organizations that these organizations probably experience the highest level of conflict than most other organizations. Because you have a group of people that have set a very high bar of high ideals. And yet at the same time, they have to consistently reconcile that high ideal with the practical grinding of day-to-day life. And that gap is bound to create an internal discomfort. Yeah? We all experience it. We want to be high warrior, but can't manage it in my day-to-day life. And so the core of the Brahma Kumaris strength is really in the practice of meditation, because that's the practice that helps us eventually reconcile this gap. Rather than using our egos to prove and achieve and create more of an empty facade, the practice of meditation starts to fill us with the good energy that we want to eventually become into. And so without that practice, I don't think that you can ever reach your highest potential, your highest ideal. And so I felt that that's been a very quiet strength within the organization. And yet, as individuals embark on a journey and we're attempting to do something together as a group, inevitably there's bound to be some difference of opinion, difference of ideas, difference of how we do things. And so the last 4 or 5 years, I've had the enormous privilege to work very closely with the regional director for the Middle East and Europe, because I'm based in London. And so I do a lot of traveling, and essentially a lot of my work is working with groups, within each of the countries. We have 36 countries in Europe and the Middle East, and each of these countries have their own center setups, you know, numbers of centers within the countries. And so just working with the core teams in the countries, the senior management of the country, the boards, and essentially really supporting their journey as they move through a rocky period of trying to collectively remain on a spiritual journey together and do the task together. Right? It's double work. Most people want to do their spiritual journeys separate to their professional lives. That's what happens, right? I'd rather just keep it separate. My work is there, my own personal spiritual life is here. And yet what I consistently see within the BK framework is that a life of service is very much linked to a life of spirituality, your own transformation. And yet, how do you manage both feet without creating even further gap inside? And I think, you know, for many of us, and if I'm, you know, absolutely honest, we have intentions and we start off with intentions to be good and to do good. But at a certain point in our life, those intentions get corrupted or mixed. And I find that my act of service is no longer a benevolent act of generosity, but it's an act of subtle taking where I'm only comfortable or I feel satisfied when I'm helping someone else move forward, but I ignore my own self-development in the process. And this is common. Major leadership weakness is over-focusing on the development of others to fill your own gap. And often it can't be seen. You know, one of the labels that's given in the world outside is often called social work. You know, I used to live in a retreat center and for 14 years, and perhaps every year we used to have two retreats for social work managers. And I have never seen a group of people come to the retreat center so burnt out. And I think to myself, my experience of service, if it's really working on the natural principle of a benevolent giving, is that when something is service, you receive a return of it. You receive blessings in return. You receive a goodwill in return. You receive energy, and it doubles your energy. But if my giving is depleting me, then is it really service? Or is my ego using the name of service to get its job done? These are some tough questions we have to face on a journey of trying to become good at an internal and external level. So you can see how, and there's a lot of margin for a lot of dissonance to happen. Conflict's a very strong word. And I think for me, as I began witnessing and working with groups and individuals in a state of conflict, I had to start reframing my own understanding of conflict. And I began to realize that through spiritual lens, I saw a few levels of conflict. One layer of conflict was a product of fixed positions, right? This is my position, I'm not moving from it. This is the other position, I'm not moving from it. Clash. I don't want to move from it. You've got to come over to my side, and you've got to come over to my side. And no one's prepared to give way. And essentially, it's an ego game. You know, it's a defense position. Another observation was that I found that conflict and the reason for conflict was just a state of an imbalance of energies. I call it a disharmony. You know, think of it at a personal level, when you overdo something physically more than your capacity. Your emotional, physical, mental, spiritual energies are in balance. You don't feel well. You create your own stress because of an imbalance. And so sometimes it's just an imbalance in energies, in the self, in my relationship with my environment, my work, that needs to be harmonized. Again, or brought back into balance. Then the third aspect that I observed around conflict was that actually it wasn't a bad thing. It might appear to be a disturbance, but actually it was producing something new. And the metaphor that came to me to describe this third level is, imagine that many years ago you've planted a seed underneath the ground and you've watered it, but you don't see the fruit or the results of that seed immediately. Right? It takes time. It's growing. You can't see it growing. But you have to be patient. You come back to the field and you let it, you water the soil. And then there comes a point when sometimes we've planted seeds and we've forgotten we've planted seeds, but they're still growing. And there comes a point when that seed starts to push its way through the cracks of the pavement, right? And sometimes those little flowers or seeds or saplings start to break the surface as it's pushing its way through. However, we've always known a stable, flat surface. So when something starts to get upset in the environment, stop. No, it can't be like this. You know, I've always known it to be flat ground, so why isn't it flat anymore? And yet, there's a little sapling trying to push its way through the surface. And as I try to stamp it down to try and be secure, because that's what I've always known, and that's how I've always known it to be, then I run the risk of suppressing a new expression. And so conflict often is a signal that there's a good and a positive change coming your way. If you can see what is the new sapling that's emerging, what's the newness coming out of all this on the horizon? And so essentially for me, when I look at it through a spiritual lens, and then through a psychological lens, you know, conflict is a personal conflict of your own emotions, desires, impulses, tendencies that cause friction inside you, you know, through a psychological lens. But through a spiritual lens, my feeling is that it's the soul's journey to come back to a state of internal balance. Balance inside itself and balance in its external life. Because where there's real truth, there is always a sense of balance. And so when I look at situations or groups or people, individuals going through conflict, I'm often making this level of assessment. Why is this occurring first? Rather than immediately trying to deal with the superficial symptoms of conflict, without actually understanding what's producing it. And repositioning myself accordingly. I mean, there's lots of courses and seminars out there that you can go to that will effectively teach you very good skills, listening and speaking and conversing. But unless you're able to spiritually discern at a much finer level the reason for energies being disharmonious, then you can't effectively use the right skill set for the right moment. And so for me, it's the first step has been about really developing a deeper level of a spiritual discernment behind what is going on when there's an imbalance of energies. Now, I've had to deal with my own personal journey and your own emotional reactions when there is conflicting and opposing energies outside you, right? It's what happens. You're never free from the process. You go in, and you go in with the attitude, right, we're going to help fix it. Next thing you know, you get slammed right back out of the process, and nobody wants your help. And you're trying to help, and nobody goes, well, we never asked you to help. You go, what am I doing here? And so in my mind, one of the first positions I had to reframe is that conflict resolution is not about fixing anything. You're not fixing anything, because if you walk in with that paradigm, it's actually a subtle position of the ego. The ego has three positions that it manifests. One is a very grandiose state, so, well, I'm the only one who can do this better than anybody else. You know, the kind of bordering of over-arrogance. Then there's the other end of the spectrum that's the kind of self depreciation. I'm not good enough, I'm not worthy, let somebody else do it, I can't do it, And you just, you know, keep cowering, getting lower. And then there's another expression of the ego which really manifests as a, earlier I was talking about, the kind of helping others to feel satisfied, you know, trying to fix a situation. And often the ego manifests a lot through that way. And so our attempts to try and help the situation sometimes make things worse. Yeah, have you ever experienced that? But I'm trying to help. Why don't you understand? And actually they just keep pushing you away. And it's a big signal that, hey, review the position from where you're coming from. And essentially, in my own journey, when I've met with people who are experiencing conflict in themselves, or group conflicts, interpersonal conflicts, I've had to really watch what is my reaction to what's going on. Yeah? Because my reaction is giving me a lot of information about the dynamics that are going on. It's a very interesting thing because I've had to really learn how to stay detached from the process. Because if I start reacting to what's going on, I fall into the soup. Right? When you fall into the soup, you're not much use to anybody. And so after a while, I kind of had to step back, and my meditation practice helped me to step back to learn to read my reaction as data. Because when I enter a situation, whatever I'm reacting to is giving me information about the dynamics of the energies going on. And if I can transform my reaction, then I will know how to support the person or the group to transform their reaction. And for me, that's been the only honest and truthful position I've been able to keep. Yeah? Is to not fall into, avoid falling into the soup of becoming part of the pot of reactivity. And so one of the second foundational strengths that needed is a great deal of emotional awareness. Personal emotional awareness. What is going on inside me? You know, to become an instrument to support the resolution of something, you need to be very savvy with your inner territory.
Savvy?
Savvy means...
knowledgeable.
Sorry?
Knowledgeable.
Knowledgeable. Yes, very knowledgeable, you know? In a detached way, a light way, but very knowledgeable about what's going on in your inner world. And I saw for myself, personally, four types of reactions emerging, essentially. Yeah. One type is the tendency to want to make everything okay. Right? We can just get on with each other and then everything will be okay. So let's just go and distract ourselves, watch a movie, let's go have a picnic, you want a cup of tea, or want to bake you a cake. It's like a gut reaction to try and make something okay, you know? And yet, something's stuffing up inside you. Why isn't everything okay? And then there's another type of reaction that happens to what's going on, where you just withdraw. You know, where it's too much to handle what's going on outside you, so you just cut. If you can't physically withdraw, you'll just mentally and emotionally check out. You'll stop listening, you'll just cut. You know, and it's like, if you're ever in a group with that kind of person, they don't say a word. You know, stone-faced, quiet, you don't know what's going on there, and they just cut. That's just total withdrawal. Another type of reaction, one that I tend to lean more towards, is attack, which is the best form of defense when you're having a reaction, right? Mm-hmm. So you poke, you take your emotional reaction, you turn around and you attack with it. You just come right out with it. That's how it is, this is what it's like, and this is what it is. And actually, it ends up with everybody going... So instead of you being an instrument to resolve the conflict, you end up fragmenting pieces even further. And then the fourth type of reaction that I've noticed is around get over intellectualizing a situation. Have you ever had you try and outthink the situation? Well, this must be the reason for this, and that must be how it's happened, and because they had a trauma in their childhood, and this and this and this and this. It's like you overanalyze the situation to such an extent, because the attempt to rationalize a situation is your safety from getting emotionally involved in it. Right? So each one of us will experience predominantly one of these four reactions to conflict. Can you see yourself in one of these four?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think it's really, for me, it's being aware of these dynamics. You know, and whenever you're reacting in any of these ways, you'll start to experience a stress and a tension. And immediately it's telling you, step back. Step back. Because the lack of self-control means that when I react, then I'll react to have another reaction to stop my reaction. Right? So I'll feel guilty about having attacked someone. So I'll try and make everything okay again. Right? And try to make everything okay, I'll stuff up again. And I'll explode again somewhere else. Right? So this practice of becoming emotionally aware is not the practice of analyzing my emotions, but of positioning myself somewhere deep as an observer and a detached observer of myself. And creating such an inner center of gravity that's very powerfully stable, has a strong base of self-respect, from a place I'm able to watch my inconsistencies, my reactions, so that I can handle them better. Emotional maturity has got nothing to do with analyzing emotion. It has a lot to do with handling and ruling yourself. When you're ruling your capacity to rule yourself and to maintain your dignity is weak, you will be emotionally weak. And so for me, the practice of meditation, and essentially we started with a very basic step at the beginning, which is just simply relax. There are layers and layers that allow a concentration of spirit, a concentration of my core goodness. Because often, as I start to operate in the day with many activities, my goodness starts to disperse. It does, doesn't it? Ego gets mixed in. And then I'm proud to do what I'm doing. And can't you see what I'm doing, what I'm doing? I want to acknowledge that I'm doing what I'm doing. And where suddenly my giving and my goodness isn't a selfless act anymore, but it's a conditional act that's feeding the ego. And so to protect my goodness, I need a period of pure reflection time every day. You cannot achieve success in your life in an altruistic way, in a benevolent way beyond you, if the first truth of keeping your feelings pure and clean isn't in place. If that work isn't done daily, of cleaning your feelings, keeping them clean, keeping them at a high frequency, then it will compromise your ability to be honest in your day-to-day life. Very powerful. You can't maintain truth. It's very difficult. And I feel that the dissonance and the gap personally is often around the difference between how much I think about something to then what I say about something and then what I do. Yeah? You think this much. Of what you think, you say this much. And of what you say, you do this much. You feel the gap, and everybody else feels the gap around you. Who here really always says what they mean? Great. Life is very freeing when...
Just did it.
It just
did it.
You just did it. You say what you mean. Imagine how liberating it is. Every time you open your mouth, you always say what you mean.
no issues with your conscience.
You'd have no issues with your heart.
So there's this personal integrity
gap
that needs to be closed, you know, as part of the process. Now, from a deeply spiritual perspective, and I'm about to go a little bit deeper, I've changed my paradigm, because if you imagine, you know, a continuum. So there's conflict resolution at one end, which is the context and paradigm of problem solving. There's someone's a problem out there, and it needs to be fixed. Okay? Then you walk across to the continuum on the other end, where we're talking about conflict, not just conflict, but there's a harmonizing process. There's a call for harmony, where there's an energy that needs to be supported. How am I supporting that energy to come back to balance? And for me, here, at this end of the continuum, is total responsibility. Where when I'm sitting as an individual in the middle of conflict, the first question I ask myself is, why is this happening in my world? Because that's the only way I can actually deal with it truthfully. I've tried dealing with something as a problem and a solution, and a problem out there and a solution, and done all the dutiful things I need to. It temporarily calms down, but never fully comes to a place of balance. And it's quite stressful, actually, to manage that position. But when I've walked myself over onto this side, and I've just asked myself the question, why have I invited this into my world? Why is this happening in my world? What is it asking from me at this time? What is it drawing out of me at this time? What are the qualities that I need to generate, or the energy that I need to generate inside to support an imbalance of external energies outside? You know, sometimes it's not about what we do that matters. Sometimes it's what we don't do that has the most impact. You know, when you hold a position long enough, and it's a very truthful and a pure position, eventually things start to order themselves around it. If you stay peaceful long enough, you hold a frequency long enough, everything around you starts to elevate to that frequency. But you need to stay there long enough. It's not just a momentary experience. Oh, well, I was peaceful for 5 minutes, but it didn't really have much effect. Well, it's not going to have much effect, because you need to keep being peaceful again and again and again and again. And as you consistently hold a state and a vibration long enough, you start to pull everything to that level of operation. Now, conflict resolution takes a very different shape in that paradigm. And that's what I've come to understand and work with. And in many ways, it's not that I enjoy conflict, but I'm grateful for the opportunity, because it's strengthening my capacity to stay firm in my inner truth and my peace and my love. Not to doubt the power of that. Because so quickly, we can compromise the purity of our position by just wanting to be right. Wanting to convince somebody of the right way because we're right. And it's something that's not about who's right and who's wrong. That's still a very polarized state. You know, in the world, I talk about the justice bandwagon. There's a lot of people on that bandwagon that are fighting for peace. You cannot fight for peace from a peaceless state. You cannot. And you'll find most people get on a justice bandwagon, and the honeymoon phase passes, and then kind of ask themselves, well, why am I doing this anyway? There's no fruit. And so that paradigm from demanding a wrong to be fixed, a wrong to be righted, is a very different paradigm of conflict resolution. And then the other side of conflict resolution is where I'm genuinely seeking harmony. And within that comes a whole capacity to listen, to bridge, to forgive, to not hold grudges of the past, to remain present in the moment without allowing the past to colour. I was in South Africa a couple of years ago, and I had gone to the Free State for a conference where they pulled together the key leaders, spiritual leaders of all the different religions in South Africa, on a conversation of the subject of reconciliation. And they had primarily invited and wanted to invite young people to it, university students. And I was invited as a speaker, and when I arrived, and the lecture or the conference was taking place in a university campus, I was very surprised to see the very low-level attendance of young people in that audience. And as I began to hear each of the different speakers speak, most of them had come from the generation of being freedom fighters from the apartheid regime. So their lens was, we were fighting for freedom, we got freedom, guys, you have to carry this fight forward. And I remember getting up and saying, it's a good message, it was relevant for your time, but for me, the lack of young people in this room is telling me that this message is redundant. That I don't think young people want to carry on your war and your struggle for freedom, because that was your story. They want to write a different story. So what's the message? What's the lens through which they're looking through? They're looking at things through the lens of harmony, through the lens of bridging, how to come together. And so how do you tailor your message so that you're not giving the next generation a justice baton to fight for freedom? Because you will not engage any young people in that message. And that's a common thing that I've seen in many, many countries I've traveled into, including in the Middle East. You know, I was in Israel for quite a period of time in between. And for me, my work with young people is very synonymous to this other work I do, because I find that the young spirit really seeks in its purity a desire for harmony. You'll find young people can easily get on, you know, come together, form groups, you know, just even in Warsaw. There's a government forum for the COP, and then there's the NGO forum. And who's actually pulling all the NGOs together? It's a group of young people. Yeah, the older ones can't get on with each other enough. And so it's a group of young people calling all the different NGOs together to mobilize something. And so in many ways, the energy of a young presence supports a harmonization process. And I know that the health of a country often lies in the health of their young ones. It's been a very clear observation I've made. So, coming back to this topic of the soft way. Right? We've talked a little bit about perhaps what the hard way looks like when we're reacting. But then, when I'm generating through personal practice my own softness, what's a soft energy? We all like to be soft. It's a very cuddly energy, isn't it? It's a very loving energy, isn't it? It's a very kind energy. It's a very gentle energy. It's a peaceful energy. It's not a passive energy. A soft energy is not a passive energy. It's just a slightly more incognito energy. That's not always obvious. Yeah? The hard energy, the energy of resistance, is more obvious, you know? If you think about a person, two people walking into this room, one's quite angry and aggressive or quite, you know, arrogant, and another one's quite stable in their peace. Who's more powerful? The peaceful one. Even though the angry one or perhaps the more arrogant one might be more impressive, but the one who's quite stable in their self-respect and peaceful actually has more staying power. And so valuing the softness of energy. And this is what we primarily generate through the practice of meditation. And when you start to become soft, you start to become like nature, accommodating, merging, tolerating, quietly discerning. And the image that had come to mind earlier was, you know, a bean bag. know these big bean bags you get, and you sit in it, and it molds to your body, right? And then you get up, and it'll mold back, or it'll stay. But you can mold it in any way, but it doesn't lose its self-respect because it's molding. It's a bean bag, right? When you look at nature, and you think, you know, gosh, it just keeps giving. There's a presence of nature that just is so natural that it just, in its presence, no matter what the human being does to it, be it throw stones at a tree, it'll give you fruit. Right? You throw rubbish into the ocean, it accommodates it, but then throws it out somewhere else. You know? But there's this amazing quality to nature that, for me, reflects the soft approach. That's why we enjoy being in nature. Because there's something about the presence of nature that helps us remind ourselves of our own original state. It's very healing, isn't it? And I feel that if we want to investigate or explore the paradigm of bringing harmony in our lives at a personal level, at an interpersonal level, in a group level, then I have to start embodying these qualities in nature. This is a wonderful metaphor to hold in my mind, so that I know what I have to be in a situation. And that comes with it a great deal of a spiritual responsibility. You have to take and make a commitment to look after yourself very, very well. And to have the courage to put yourself first in your life. Most of us who are in positions of responsibility, be it in the household, children, often tend to put ourselves at the back of the queue. Right? Help everyone else, I'm at the back of the queue, and after a period of time, I'm totally emptied. And yet, to be effective in enabling others to remain balanced, my own energy is crucial. As I continue to shine like the sun, I give permission to people around me to shine. The warmth that radiates from me helps them feel safe and secure and brings out the best in them. If people in my world are not experiencing their best, then I have to ask myself the question, what am I not radiating enough of? What am I not generating enough of? You know, I realize this very early on, this quality of jealousy. There are many things that create conflict, but one of the seed things, and especially in interpersonal relationships, it's common, it takes many different forms, is jealousy. And most often we are not consciously aware that we're jealous. But the jealousy comes from a very deep place of laziness. You know, where I haven't taken responsibility for my own progress, and actually, at some deep level, I can't bear to see anyone else progress around me. And so mentally, the reaction to that is I will criticize them mentally because it's an attempt to bring them down. I feel comfortable if I've just brought them down. But you don't know the seed of that criticism comes from jealousy. It's a very damaging emotion that's not often picked up or recognized. You know, but it's quietly working as a virus inside. And I remember, you know, there came a point in my journey when I was faced with jealousy. And you can take the approach to jealousy, well, why are they like that? You know, let them mind their own business, and you know, they don't, what do they have to be jealous about? I'm not doing anything to them. And then it took me a while to develop a benevolent position. But if someone's jealous, in that moment, they're experiencing a deficit of something in themselves. So all that's telling me, if someone's jealous of me, is they're just saying to me, give me this. So can I not have the generosity of spirit to just turn myself up, extend myself more, to just fill that gap? And so whatever it is that they need in that moment, be it love, be it respect, be it peace, be it quiet, whatever it is, can I not extend myself to give them what they need in that moment? And this helped me a tremendous amount because I realized how jealousy, on one hand, the experience of deficit, if you really start to see through a spiritual lens creates a generosity of spirit. And when you're really abundant in your energy, souls in your company will never experience a deficit. They'll enjoy being in your company because they feel safe. They feel fulfilled. They want to come close. But if there's a slight bit of ego in your energy, then the ego creates separation. People feel insecure with you. You might be brilliant and talented and skilled, great, but you're not very comfortable to be around. Yeah? People don't feel comfortable being around you. So there's this abundance that I feel we need to generate as individuals. And for me, that abundance is generated through the practice of meditation, but specifically, there's one area of meditation that has to do with the self, where I'm tuning in to my own feelings, my own originality, my own goodness. But another part of meditation is about drawing power. Because I can momentarily sit down and relax and feel peaceful and connect to a nice memory, connect to an aspect of my goodness, feel good. But you need power to stay there for a long period of time without letting your old habits, tendencies, impulse, desires overtake and destroy that space. And that power for me has come through my connection with the Supreme, with God. That as I consistently touch base with a power source that is beyond me, an incorruptible power source, it guarantees my ability to become powerful. Not just full of virtues and values, but my virtues become a power that enable others to become virtuous as well. Because I think one of the reasons why we suffer in our lives is that we might want to live a good life, but we also want to create goodness in our relationships, in our environment, encourage goodness, and yet we feel helpless in doing that. It takes power, a lot of power. So most people say to me, well, can you meditate without God? And I say, yes, you can. If you want to just feel comfortable, peaceful, and you've managed to create a space in your life where you don't have to interact with too many people and you're happy just living your own boat, no problem. But if you want to exist in a gathering, in a family, in a bigger environment, then you're going to need a lot of power. Because that's where it's easy to it's easy to become insecure. Most people become very insecure when they get into a gathering. I often find when I work with groups is that there's a balance of three things that need to be managed. And this can work with a family as a group, a professional life as a group. One is clarity around what we're meant to be doing together. Why have we come together? Right? What have we meant to do together? Especially within a professional context. I often find that a lot of conflict and upset happens because there's no clarity around the task. What exactly are we doing? Where are we going? And building the momentum on what we need to do together, clarity. The other thing that needs to be managed is creating a caring and supportive atmosphere within a group setting. You need to be able to generate an atmosphere because it softens. One of the first things I did before we started was invite you all to relaxation. What was I doing? I was paying attention to building an atmosphere before I actually started speaking about the topic. Atmosphere preparation is extremely important in managing energies and dynamics in a group. Right? And then the third element that I find myself managing is insecurities in a group. If you manage the atmosphere and manage the task well, you minimize people's insecurities emerging. But if these both aren't managed, then people's insecurities explode. Right? Because their personal needs aren't being met in a group, or there's power games going on, right? Competition, position issues. And insecurities manifest in many, many different ways. And it requires a lot of power
and a lot of love and a lot of humility to dissolve the ego. You don't dissolve the ego through the intellect. You can't convince someone to release a position. It doesn't work. You have to go beyond your ego and access a very deep level of silence and purity of feeling and vibration that just helps the soul soften their position. So they become more malleable and open to a conversation and a discussion. And as you're able to soften that position, there's a possibility for information to be exchanged to allow something new to emerge. So there's a lot going on in this subject when we talk about the software. And I'm looking at the clock and I've spoken for an hour. And I know we have to be out of this place by 9, but I could go on if you let me go on. you might be sitting here all night and then we get charged till tomorrow morning, which wouldn't be a problem with it. So I'm just wondering, has any of that helped?
Yes.
Has it made sense?
Yes.
Yeah? You kind of found yourself in it somewhere?
We know that crisis means change, don't you mean? And my thought just came into my head when you were talking that, why the conflict? Why conflict at all?
Yeah.
And so usually, well, it's just an observation on my part, there's to remember that crisis, it's a crisis in the group, it's just a crisis point. And that's why there's conflict. So my question is just, do you relate this to his crisis, the notion of crisis?
Yes. I think it touches upon something I was mentioning earlier when I started the talk, was about the third aspect of what I see as conflict is actually an opportunity for change. It's not actually a conflict, but there's an opportunity of something new emerging. And if I can keep my eye on that, then I don't end up managing a crisis, but my focus is on helping what is new to grow. So I don't give my attention to sustaining an old energy. Because if you end up trying to manage a crisis, you deplete yourself. And that's been my focus. But when I walked into a soup and I recognized, there's something emerging out of this, let me just look on the horizon. What's new? And I hone in on that, and I give that 90% of my attention. I generate energy. When you focus on generating energy, it helps you stay in a crisis safely without being consumed by it. But if you haven't got your eye on what needs to be generated, then you get consumed by the crisis because your ego is reacting to it and wants to fix it. And you can't fix it and you're stressed by it. And I've had a lot of these experiences of how when you keep your eye on what is new quietly, you need a lot of quietness for that, then eventually as you keep putting attention on that thing and you make it bigger and bigger and bigger, you help the situation come out of a crisis. You start creating that light that is at the end of the tunnel, if you like, right? Or that little stream in the dark wood and you see the light and you follow it. That's what you do.
How do you differentiate being peaceful and just accepting the situation?
How do you differentiate being peaceful and just accepting the situation? I think for me, they're two different energies. Being peaceful does not mean being passive and not discerning what's going on. Right? And actually, you can only accept something when you've discerned it. When you know what's going on, you can accept it for what it is. But if you haven't discerned it, and that's the bridge, I think, if you haven't discerned something, then you're just reacting to it. And it's just telling you haven't understood it.
And so sometimes we think it's peaceful, but it's not, because you're being passive. You haven't discerned something. You can maintain your peace if you've discerned it. And then your peace becomes a quiet energy of support in the situation. Because internally, you're not blaming yourself, you're not blaming anyone else for it. You know why something is happening and what it's happening for. And you know where to focus your energies. Right? So acceptance is not just a blind, well, that's the way I do, what can I do? It's helpless, I'm helpless. It's not coming from a place of helplessness, but from actually a deep place of wisdom, of knowing when to let something be, and knowing when to act on something. But it comes from deep discernment. We need to activate our discernment, not switch it off. Yeah. And discernment is different from reactivity, which is what tends to happen 90% of the time.
Can you discern without being judgmental?
Good question. Can you discern without being judgmental? What do you think?
Yes.
Yes? Yeah. You can, but it's a fine line, right? Isn't it? This is one of the fine line where the ego can quickly get mixed in. Because my discerning has to bring me to a place of understanding about a situation. And how do you know when you are genuinely understanding something? What are the signs? What's the quality linked to understanding? When you really understood something, what's the quality that it evokes and awakens inside?
Sort of peaceful joy,
a kind of a peaceful joy. What else? What's the other quality that understanding evokes?
Non-judgmental.
Acceptance, non-judgmental, a quality, so it's a proactive energy. Compassion.
Yes.
You know, when there's a greater understanding about something, the quality and the feeling is a greater compassion. That's the sign when you're accurately discerning something. But when your discernment makes you take a position in a situation, that's when you can become patronizing. Yeah? You know, many times, even on a spiritual journey, spirituality and morality are two separate things. And people will take a moral stance. And it's actually quite a patronizing stance in a situation. So they're discerning just through the lens of morals and ethics. But it's positional. It's not breeding compassion in the situation. But when you're really discerning accurately from a spiritual place, then it can only evoke compassion. Yeah. And so it requires a lot of honesty inside. You know, and a genuine desire to want to understand something rather than just take a moral position in the situation.
Speak like Dalai Lama. He just wrote a book about that.
Compassion. I think sometimes, for me, I think sometimes it's been about discerning, has been about suspending my intellect, the use of my intellect in a situation. Often, we confuse discernment with analysis. And these are two very different things. Because what are we taught in the world, right? I had a legal background. I was supposed to be a lawyer. You're taught to analyze everything. You're taught to apply your intellect to everything. Analyze that, think through it, why's what, pros, cons. You know? It's an extended use of the intellect. But when you're working with people, and you're in a group in a gathering setting, you've got to suspend your intellect. Because when you suspend your intellect, you'll start tuning in to what is non-verbal in a situation, which is actually where 70-80% of your information understanding is going to develop from. When you start reading all the non-verbal signals. Yeah? Yes?
the internet, is that also the experience you bring into the table? I mean, that you see things naively, objective, just as it is, instead of bringing all your experience to the table?
Yeah, the function of the intellect is a very a discernment function. But sometimes you have to suspend all your life experience in that moment to listen in a pure way without the lens of what I know to be right, what I know to be true, I've got so much experience. Because that's when you can easily lose the neutrality of your position and take another moral position or an egoistic position. And so, you know, when you live with spirituality, who cares about your experience? Who cares I've done this much in my life? It doesn't matter because my life is not defined by my past, but it's defined by my quality of being right now.
Amen.
You know, so it's a very pure living experience of being present in the moment. Yes.
Is there a difference between being judgmental and making judgments?
I would probably say there's a difference between being judgmental and making an assessment. Right? So when I'm discerning, I'm making an assessment. And that's different. Being judgmental, for me, I've often lost objectivity. And I can't see clearly. And the judgment just locks me in a reaction.
Yeah.
Yes?
I was just trying to make sense of what you said earlier about jealousy and the deficit of in the spirit. As far as I understood you, it seems like something goes... It's something that is masked in a lot of things that we do, jealousy. And I was just thinking, just to become aware of it, can you say a little bit more about that? Because I didn't get all of it. You said the opposite of jealousy was benevolence. So I was just thinking in a daily life, how does that come to be, jealousy? I'm a mother, I have two small children, and, you know, have a job and stuff.
I think for me, as I've observed the energy of jealousy, it carries many expressions that we don't often link to it. Mm. Expectations of others, criticism is one. And these are not obvious connections we make. But the state of jealousy is a state of deficit where I have certain desires that have not been fulfilled and I'm not taking active steps to fill my own needs.
In myself.
In myself, primarily. And if I'm not taking active steps to fill my own needs, there are many consequences of that. They either get projected out as a form of expectation, or I can't. And it'll manifest in different ways in different settings in my life. In my professional field, it'll manifest as trying to who goes ahead, who gets pulled back. You know, within a personal context, it gets manifest as expectations in interpersonal relationships. But we don't often make the connection to this. Yes?
So how can you fix that by then being, you said something about just projecting more radiance if someone was jealous of you. And then something in... Yeah.
I think at its root, I have to address the root of fulfillment, self-fulfillment. That's really important. When you're dissolving an energy of subtle jealousy inside, it comes from comparison, competition, you know, all of that nonsense that also manifests from jealousy. But the root of it is, what am I doing to generate a sense of fulfillment for myself? How proactive am I in looking after myself and my own needs? You know, it's to really give yourself an energy injection every day. So you're satisfied from your stomach before you start today. Because if you're not satisfied from your stomach, you will seek that satisfaction in unconscious ways throughout your day. That's how it works.
But I was thinking about that you said that you felt that you had to, if someone was jealous of you,
yes,
then that you had to radiate more love for them.
Yeah. It was also telling me that I wasn't paying enough attention to the quality of my energy. You know, it's very interesting for me. I've noticed my day starts 3:45 in the morning and sometimes finishes at 11 o'clock at night. And some days I'll be lucky if I get an afternoon nap, you know. But you know, I'll find some space, but I meditate at least 2 hours a day, so I get a lot of energy that way. But I've noticed, and I have to do a lot, and I've noticed that the times when I've left my attention slip from really just being attentive to myself in action, doing things gracefully and peacefully and quietly, to kind of getting caught up in the rush, I'll be doing the right things, but I'll get a reaction from others. And what that reaction is telling me is, Gopi, just slow down. Don't compromise the quality of your energy whilst doing something. That's what it's telling me. I just have to pay more attention to the benevolence of my energy, that somewhere I've let it slip and become compromised in a task. In a bid to get the job done well, I've let my thinking become cheap. Yeah? You can be efficient, but you can't necessarily be effective. There's a big difference.
Can jealousy also be a good feeling? Because it gives you a signal. Step up, take actions, be a motivator. You want to reach at the same point.
Yeah, I think it can be a trigger towards you kind of stepping up, because they are just triggers, right? They're just signals saying, don't go down this way, take another route. If you can read the signal.
If you acknowledge that feeling,
yeah,
you can actually turn it around.
You can turn it around. And you actually, this is a very good point, because you end up Tai Chiing your negativity, right? You don't beat yourself up for being jealous, but when there is an emotional maturity, the soft approach is you go with it, you Tai Chi it, and channel it, because you learn from it.
It's a great song between being competitive as well, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be just as good, so you want to train harder, you want to do hard, you want to work hard.
That's one aspect of looking at it. The other aspect of looking at it is I just want to be myself. You know, myself to my fullest. So being myself, not in comparison to anyone else, where I have to be as good as them, but I want to reach my perfection. I want to reach my excellence in whatever shape or form that may take.
I was just thinking whether you could say something more about being satisfied from my stomach.
It's a feeling. For me, it's a feeling. You know, when I sit for my morning meditation, I let myself fully become peaceful. I have created a habit of letting myself fully become peaceful before I start the day. And I won't, and you know, initially when you sit to become peaceful, there's a twitch here, a twitch there, there's stuff coming in, stuff coming out. It's a little bit like water that's disturbed, but if you leave a glass long enough, the water settles. Your original state is peace. It will take over if you just sit still long enough.
But is that peace enough for the rest of the day? For all the doing this and doing that?
Well, yeah, it's like fuel, right?
Yeah, because I was just thinking, if jealousy doesn't creep in there somewhere, is that because your level of peace is going down?
I think it's a level of your quality is going down, definitely. So connection in the day, you know, we call them traffic control moments. I stop on the hour to just reconnect again, to refuel, and then come back up again. Self-management at a very deep level. Okay, last question, and then we need to stop because it's 5 to 9, yes.
When you talk about morality, do you mean like values? Because I have an issue with somebody who's close to me,
mm-hmm,
who really is challenging my values about the lie.
Yeah.
What is the, because I really feel, start to moralize about you cannot lie and stuff like
yeah,
that. So what is the soft approach to that challenge of actually finding the compassion for the other person? Because I'm really challenged on my values.
You know, there's one set of values that are acquired that come and are shaped as a result of the family, culture, life experience we've packaged, right? And as we adopt those values, we call them etiquette, we call them ethics that have developed, a work ethic, a life ethic, the ethics. And yet, somehow, we live by those ethics, and they give us a certain degree of self-respect or position, but they don't necessarily fill a gap inside. Okay? And then there is a set of values that are deeply innate, that you know, right down to the bottom, each soul just wants the experience of love and peace and deep respect. So can I tune into that need? So you bypass the moral back and forth, and you just tune in and ask myself the question, what does this soul really need at this point in time? Let me just give that energy. If they just need to be listened to, let me listen. See what I mean? So the soft approach is discerning the need beyond the position of moralizing with each other. Thank you. Thank you for a lovely conversation. Moments. Open your heart. And ask yourself, what have you been inspired by this evening? What has stirred feeling or insight to expand and fill your heart like a light illuminating the space in your heart. And just allow the light of that realization or pure feeling gift, a pure vibrational gift.
knowing that every time I come close to myself, I'm helping someone else come close to themselves. As my inner light awakens and shines, it gives permission for others to be the same. Transformation is the gift to the world. Om Shanti. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.